Welcome. My name is Vishwas Lele, and I'm going to talk about the latest advancements in Azure IaaS and for developers and for IT pros, and I'm really excited to be here. So let me get started. And before I do, let me just have a quick slide here. If you have questions, please tweet it with this hashtag, and I'll try to respond to them through as I present my session. So before I show you the agenda slide, I thought I will give you a quick key objective that I wanted for this session. And rather than enumerating through all of the announcements that have come across in the last several months, which frankly you can look at the RSS feed called Azure Updates, my objective here is to present these enhancements in the context of design choices that are available to you as a developer or as an IT pro. So as I was preparing for this session, there are two questions that kept coming back to me. And I thought these are the questions that you probably have in your mind as you were watching this session. Question number one, Vishwas, I'm a developer and my job is to design the software and to build it, but is it not somebody else's job to then deploy it and to optimize the deployment? That's a fair question. Question two, Vishwas, you are a developer. And how come you're talking about the IT Pro enhancements? What standing do you have to talk about the IT Pro enhancements? That's a fair question as well. Well, as you know, as a developer, like many of you, I gravitated towards platform as a service and started using that for a number of years. But about 2 years back, I realized that unless you're trying to build a cloud-native workload, or if you're trying to take your application, refactor it, and move it to the cloud, unless you're doing that, for most customers, the place to start is infrastructure as a service. So in the last 2 years, I've tried to teach myself infrastructure as a service. So my response to the question two would be, as IT pros, even though the high-level concepts are the same, whether it is network, compute, and storage, but the fundamentals of the cloud are significantly different, whether it is software-defined networking, software-defined storage, automation. And similarly, I would say to developers that you need to get involved with the run side of the application. So to be able to build more fault-tolerant applications, to build applications that scale, to build applications that are cost-effective, you need to understand the underpinnings of the data center and hence understanding of IaaS. So the thing I would say before I leave this slide is, if we are going to be successful in the cloud, I think developers need to know more about the underpinnings, and IT pros need to think like developers and maybe get an understanding of the API, the JSON files, the REST API, and things like that. So with that said, let me bring up the agenda slide. Very simple. I'm going to motivate the topic of infrastructure as a service quickly, and then I'm going to spend the rest of the session into two parts. One was about infrastructure service for developers, and then I will talk about advancements for IT pros. So let's get started. So first and foremost, just to motivate the topic of infrastructure as a service, if you look at the importance of IaaS to businesses, it cannot be understated. Just look at the investments that companies, not only Azure, but other large companies are making. And frankly, there are a number of startups in this space that are innovating at a rapid pace. Ultimately, though, IaaS is about flexibility. So maybe there's a characteristic of your application that does not line up with PaaS, and you need to use IaaS for that. Maybe there is a performance constraint. Maybe there's some kind of a compliance constraint that is preventing you from just using the PaaS. In such cases, you'll find that IaaS is more flexible. And in fact, I talk to IT pros or I talk to IT directors, and as they're looking at the application portfolio that is going to move to the cloud, oftentimes IaaS is that on-ramp to the cloud. And the last point in this slide is, even though we've been talking about IaaS and PaaS as two separate entities, what we are seeing now is that the line between IaaS and PaaS is blurring. So you can get the flexibility that you get from a VM, but you can also get the lower cost of ownership that comes with a PaaS service. So now that we know the importance of IaaS, let's quickly take a look at the popular IaaS workloads. Lift and shift, as the name suggests, taking an application and moving it to the cloud. But one thing you have to keep in mind, usually the challenge is that maybe the application that you're trying to lift and shift has some kind of a performance characteristic which cannot be supported in the cloud. And the announcements that we saw yesterday, like the G-series machines, which number of cores and high number of memory can solve that problem. You can also see projects where you're taking an existing application and maybe refactoring a small part and moving to the cloud. I've worked on one project recently like that. Moved the pieces to IaaS, but then took the SQL CLR portion, converted into T-SQL, and ran it on SQL CL, on Azure SQL database. So there are many customers who are not just moving their compute instances to the cloud, they are looking at cloud as a storage medium. And if you've heard of things like Azure Recovery or Site Recovery, you can take your existing VMs running on premises and then back them up in the cloud. The virtual branch office scenario is very interesting as well. So you're not going to take your resources and just move them away just because you want to move to the cloud. You're not going to be able to do that. So when you receive new requests for new resources and new capacity, perhaps you want to move those resources or provision those resources in a cloud and think of that data center as your virtual office extension to your on-premises data center. So that's an important workload there. Everybody needs VMs. As developers, we are constantly getting VMs for testing, setting up games on machines. So everybody needs VMs. And then you have not just the need for a VM. Many times you're getting a collection of VMs creating your dev test environment. So these are some of the important workloads that we see often with the IaaS. And before I go into the main section of the presentation, I realize that I'm going to be focusing on the advancements that have happened in the last 6 months. So we don't have time to talk about some of the more fundamental announcements that came out when the service was first announced. So that we are on the same page, let me run through some important concepts here so that I can, when I use the terms later on in the presentation, you know what I'm talking about. So virtual machine, hopefully it is not a surprise to anyone that you can provision virtual machines in Azure, and you can provision Windows-based virtual machines, you can provision Linux-based virtual machines. And in fact, I just read this yesterday, 1 out of every 5 virtual machine provision in Azure is a Linux-based machine. So you can see here there are a number of types of VMs that are available to you. The important thing is to figure out which type of VM do you want. If you're only trying to do some testing, maybe you can just get a standard instance without any SLA, or you can get the A-series machines and they keep adding new ones to the list. A8 and A9 got added, good for HPC style computing. And then there's this D-series machine that was announced recently, which is really about SSDs on the local drive. And then, of course, this just in, yesterday Scott and Satya announced the G-series machines, the premium storage, et cetera. So now your VMs are persisted in Azure Blob Storage, and that's an important concept to understand. And you have OS and data disks, and then you have now SSDs as well. Because your disks are persisted in the Azure Blob Storage, and because Azure Blob Storage has a strong story around geo-replication, you're able to very easily take your virtual disks and move them around. That's an important concept. Load balance sets and availability set, think of taking your virtual machines, pairing them up so that you get high availability. In fact, that's the only way you get the SLA. Virtual network, think of this as your custom overlay on top of Azure network. So this is your network, only your traffic goes on it. Your virtual network can be broken up into subnets, and think of subnets as a pool of IP addresses. Then you have this notion of regional VNet, and before I explain that, up until now, VNets used to be associated with an affinity group. So if you're building a web application, you have the app tier, you have the web tier, you want these tiers to be together, you put them in an affinity group. That concept still applies. But what is new is now you can create a VNet which spans a region. And furthermore, you can take a VNet in one region and connect it to another region. So you can go across regions, which is a big deal. And then you also have the ILB, or the internal load balancer. Up until now, you had to come through a public endpoint to get the load balancer, but now you can get an internal load balancer. And then finally, you have the site-to-site connectivity, which is an IPsec-based connectivity. But what if you have an individual machine that is trying to connect to Azure? You can have a point-to-site connectivity, which is a local VPN client based on secure sockets. So moving on, one more slide of concepts and then we will move on to the session. So another important concept, something called the preview portal, and this is important. This is not just the nice looking portal that everybody is talking about. It has two important concepts. And Michael Collier talked about the resource manager this morning, and I'll talk some more about it. But the idea is that you're able to logically organize your resources, which you could not do up until now. So if you go to the current portal, you hit the VM tab, you see a list of VMs. But these are all the VMs in that subscription. There's no way to logically organize them. Resource groups give you that concept. Then you have this notion of RBAC, or role-based security, which is available in the preview portal. So I suggest you check that out. Then you have the VIP, the external IP address. And the new thing there is now you have the ability to do persistent IP addresses. And then you also can do things like the reverse DNS. Perhaps the most exciting announcement in the last 6 months is ExpressRoute. So if you're trying to connect your data center with Azure, then you have to today set up a some kind of connectivity that goes over the public internet, and you can certainly do that. But what ExpressRoute gives you is this dedicated connection between your data center and the Windows Azure data center, on-premises data center and Windows Azure. And you can do it two ways. You can get yourself an MPLS link from someone like AT&T, or you can go with an exchange provider model. So you can take your application, host it with an exchange provider such as Equinix or Level 3, and then these data centers have connectivity to Azure, so you can get a direct connectivity via that format. My personal favorite, extensions. I talked about how the boundaries between IaaS and PaaS are merging, and I believe extensions have a big story to play here. Because now, like we used to do previously with the cloud services, you have this agent running on the IaaS machines, and that agent can then bootstrap Microsoft and non-Microsoft agents to do some interesting things, such as compliance, et cetera. And of course, Azure is not just about the Windows workloads. We are finding that other vendors are certifying their products, Oracle, SAP, they are certifying their products, and not just certifying their products, but they're offering license mobility. So if you have a license, you can take that to the cloud, and they're also offering a utility-based billing model, which is really important. So hopefully this was a very quick trip through the important concepts, but they'll be useful as we go through the remainder of the session. So I'm going to switch gears. I've gone through the motivation for IaaS. I've talked about the workloads in IaaS, and we talked about the key concepts. Let's just move into the key advancements for developers in IaaS. And before I start with this next section, I have to give credit where credit is due. You will see a number of demos, and many of my colleagues at Applied Information Sciences helped me. In particular, I'd like to call out Jack O'Connell and Swami, who worked really hard to help me with this demo. So guys, thank you very much. Let's start out with our first advancement. Let's talk about tooling. So if you've worked with Azure, tooling is not new. So if you're working with cloud services, you can simply launch a cloud emulator, test your application inside Visual Studio, and then once you've tested it, go deploy your application to the cloud. So that's been around for a long time. You can now do mobile services, you can do Azure websites, but what is new here is now you can do tooling for infrastructure service as well. So what do you get with that? You get to create a VM, you get to capture a VM, which means make a copy, you can start a VM, so you can do a bunch of things. Now, what is interesting is that once a tooling for a certain functionality begins to appear inside Visual Studio, and that's just my observation, that means that Microsoft is expecting a broad section of developers to start using that functionality. So that's an important data point in itself. So let me go ahead and show you a quick demo of remote debugging, and then we'll come back and talk about what specific things is that offering. So I'm going to switch gears here, and of course, this is an IaaS session. So I am, rather than installing all the demos on my machine, I'm going to RDP into one of the machines. And here's a little tip. If you're an MSDN subscriber, you have access to all the VMs with Visual Studios and latest version of Visual Studio installed. So you can very quickly set one up like the one I'm going to show you. So I'm going to go into Visual Studio. And just making sure you can see this. So I'm going to Visual Studio. And all I've done here is just created file project new or some simple application here. And one thing that I can't show you because it takes about 5 minutes to do that is when I was doing that file new project, I targeted a virtual machine as my intended place where I wanted to deploy my application. And at that point, Visual Studio asked me for my Azure credentials, and then it provisioned a machine for me, and then it put some extensions on it, like the web deploy extension and things like that. So that's what happened before you started watching this, and I created this machine. So what I'm going to show you here is, let's just look at the Server Explorer. And let me get myself the Solution Explorer back here. And okay, let's just expand this. Okay, there you go. And let me also get myself the Solution Explorer. And let's just move this out here a little bit. Okay. And my screen resolution is off, so it's taking me just a quick second to figure out what's happening. Well, in this case, what's happening is I got myself the solution or the Server Explorer, and that's what I was looking for. And this is the machine that was provisioned for me. Okay. So what I can do right now, and if I right click here, you can see that I can now attach a debugger to this machine. And before I do that, let me just go ahead and actually prime that website so that you can see it here. I actually went ahead and deployed that application. So let me just bring up that site. And this is a very simple, this is the file new project site. Let it load here for a second so that the W3WP process is active. So let's just go ahead and wait for this for a second here, and this will take to load. And in the meantime, let me go back to Visual Studio. And now I'm going to go and attach my debugger. Now notice that I'm inside a virtual machine. I created this project, and then I did a web deploy of this project to this virtual machine. And I'm not going to now attach a debugger to that. And this is going to go connect to that debugger here a second. And let's see if the page did come up. The page did come up. So we've primed the W3WP process. Let's go back to Visual Studio. And here it is. It is showing me all the processes in that machine. Let's just sort it so we can get the W3WP process, and let's go ahead and attach to it. And usually the thing that you have to watch out here is that if you are trying to load all the symbols, looks like we were able to attach successfully. And what I'm going to do next here, as you can see here, it is taking a second, and now looks like the symbols got loaded. And if you're doing this for a more complex application, you have to make sure that the symbol server is available. So now what is happening is we have attached to a virtual machine that is running in Azure, and then because of the web deploy extension, and oh, by the way, I talked about the concept of extensions. There is also some extensions that the Visual Studio team wrote, and in particular, there's a VM debugger extension that got deployed as part of enabling remote debugging. Okay, so now we have attached the debugger, and because our symbols are loaded, you can see the breakpoints highlighted. Let's go back to the application and just refresh this page here. And once I refresh this page, let me go back to my virtual machine, and let me go to the right virtual machine, and there you have it. As you can see, I got my breakpoint was hit, and at this point, I can go ahead and debug this application. Now, a couple of points I would like to very quickly make about this. One is that this is not just a machine that is dedicated to me. I can be a part of a team that is building this application. So what I can do is I can give the certificate to a co-developer in my team, and they can then connect to this machine and debug also. What you can also do, let me go back to the Server Explorer, you can also do is if I go into the Properties tab here, and this takes a second, in fact, I have this tab open here, and let me just call out this button here called Capture Image, and this is important because let's say you're debugging this application, you found an issue, and you want to send that issue to perhaps another team, you can hit Capture. At this point, even though the machine is running, it will take a running snapshot of that machine, and not just the OS disk, but OS and data disks, and you can ship this off to someone else who can then spin up a machine and recreate an issue quickly. Okay, so going back to the slides here. So what we saw here was that in infrastructure service, there's new tooling. It can help with remote debugging. You can take snapshots. You can give it to another team, and so on and so forth. So that's the first advancement that I want to talk about. The second advancement that I want to talk about is related to the resource manager. And I'm not going to spend too much time because Michael did a great job this morning of talking about resource manager, but I want to present it from the perspective of infrastructure as a service. I already said that if you go to the portal today, you see all the virtual machines, you see all the storage accounts under one tab, one for VM, one for storage, but you can't logically organize them. So resource group, think of it as a logical organization of resources, but it is more than that. It is also a scale unit. It is also a management boundary. So if you're trying to figure out how much is these set of resources costing me, the resource manager gives you that ability to do that. So the other important benefit of resource manager is that you can use it both declaratively and imperatively. So imperative, we know, you can go ahead and write a sequential program, write a script to provision a certain resource, and then follow by that with another resource and so on and so forth. But in the declarative model, you basically write up a JSON file which has all the dependencies and give it to the resource manager engine, if you will, and it will then smartly figure out what are the dependencies and then even parallelize the operation for you. So it is an important concept to understand, and it gives you the consistency of management, and it gives you that application lifecycle container model, which includes all your resources. So let me quickly show you a demonstration of that. And just to keep the demo simple, I'm just going to fire off a bunch of JSON commands. And I told you I like the declarative model, so I'm going to use the declarative model right here. And let's just go ahead and you can see here that I'm using this right here. This is my API right now, management.azure.com, and I'm passing the subscription. And then if I further scroll to the right here, you can see that I'm trying to create a resource, or I'm trying to get, this is a get call, sorry. So I'm trying to get all of the resource groups. So let me go ahead and go hit this command, and this might fail because my bearer token may have expired. So in that case, we'll go get ourselves a new bearer token. Let's see if it runs. Authentication failed, that's fine. Let me just go ahead and get a new bearer token very quickly. And I am going to go to the portal here, and now let's just browse around for a second. That should be enough to get us a bearer token. And let's see if we did manage to get one, right? We did. And let me just copy the bearer token value here. Let me remember to turn off Fiddler. And in fact, let's just close it down to be sure. Okay, so I got the new bearer token. Hopefully things will work better this time. I'm going to leave everything the same. I'm just going to replace the bearer token. And let's just try this time again. And looks like it succeeded. So I got all of my resource groups back. Okay, let's do some more. Let's go ahead and create a new resource group. And I'll have to remember to change the bearer token for this call as well. And in this case, I'm making a put call. I'm getting a new resource group. Let's go ahead and send this command. And this will hopefully create a new resource group for us. So wait for a second here. So there you have it. Looks like our call succeeded. Okay, very good. I can actually go on and inside this resource group, maybe I should just create a database instance, and I'll show you how that is done. Once again, the same API, but if I scroll to the right here, and this part is important, and I'm actually, let me scroll too soon here. So let's just scroll to the right. And inside this resource group, and I'll stop here for a second to show you what I mean. Inside this resource group, I'm creating a SQL instance called the sample data store. Okay, so let's go ahead and run this, change the bearer token, create a database instance, and let's see if it succeeded. Let's see. Well, this was just an extra step. Let's try it again. And subscription not found, so I think I may have gotten the wrong. So bearer token, that's fine. Let's just go make sure I got, let's just run the Fiddler again, and we'll get the bearer token. So I'll come back to this in a second. So the idea is you saw that I was able to get the bearer token, and the reason I was getting, okay, the reason I was getting this error was because I was trying to create that SQL in another subscription, so I needed the bearer token for that subscription, but you get the idea. I got the bearer token, I created a resource group, and in fact, if we went back to this portal And you will see here, let's just browse here, and you should see the resource group that we just created right here. Okay, this is the resource group we just created. All right, so moving on here, so the key concept here is that you have a declarative model where you're able to organize these resources and then provision these resources in a consistent manner. Moving on, so I was debating whether to show this slide as part of the developer enhancements or I should show this as part of the IT Pro enhancements. So what I decided was I will very quickly show you the concept slide here, but I'll show you the demo in the second part. So what I want to really call out here, and let me zoom into this very quickly. So up until now, and I said this before, up until now, there was no way for you to connect between these data centers. And really, the workaround was not that great. You had to go all the way from your one data center to on-premises back to another data center, and which you can imagine can be difficult. So with the new virtual network capability, you can connect virtual network to virtual network. In fact, we'll see a demonstration of that shortly. And then the last thing I wanted to call out in this slide is that you have this ability of running internal load balancer here, okay? And once you have that internal load balancer, you just don't just have to be a public VIP. It can be an internal load balancer. So what if you are coming from an on-premises location? You can still hit an internal load balancer. Why is this important? You're setting up a SharePoint farm. Your users are coming in over a VNet connectivity, a site-to-site connectivity. They can still hit the internal load balancer in this manner. That's an important concept to understand. And let's just go back and move to the next slide. So the next advancement that I want to talk about is related to networking, but specifically I want to talk about something called the Traffic Manager. And some of you have probably used it. This service went GA recently. And the idea, and in fact, the best way to understand the Traffic Manager is to see the next slide here. And the idea is quite simple. Think of Traffic Manager as a DNS server with a policy engine built in. So the idea is that you can deploy your applications to multiple data centers. You can deploy them in as many data centers as you want, and then go register these endpoints with this policy engine of the Traffic Manager. The Traffic Manager will then give you a unique endpoint or URL, and then you give that URL to your users. So your users will come to the Windows Azure Traffic Manager, that's step number two, run through the policy engine. And what is this policy engine that I talk about? Well, do you want to load balance your users across geographies, or do you want to purely use it as a fault tolerance mechanism? So you can define your policies there. Once the policy execution runs, they will get a URL back, and then this URL, that address will be returned back to the user, and then they can go access the application that is based on the policy. So that's the whole idea of the Traffic Manager. And I have a very simple demonstration to show you. In fact, this is interesting because this proof of concept was built for law enforcement agencies. And imagine that, if there's some unfortunate event happens and the law enforcement agency around the world, they want to collect information about that incident. Maybe they're trying to ask public about, have they seen anything or they've heard anything? And in the past, setting up such a site which is around the world across the data centers has been hard. You have to, it can take days, if not weeks, to set up such a system. And so we built this proof of concept. The idea was that you can come in very quickly, define the look and feel of your application, define what data centers you want to go, and you can quickly provision these applications on the fly. And once you have done that, you can then register these different data centers in a Traffic Manager, and then your users can get a load balance experience across these different data centers. Okay, so that's the idea. So let me go ahead and bring up that demonstration here very quick. And I am going to close this window, which I don't need. And let's also close this. Okay, so let me bring up this demonstration. And the hardest part, you know, of doing this demonstration is to remember all the URLs and the password, of course. So I'm going to bring up this application here in a second. This should load up momentarily. And the idea behind this application is that I should be able to go in and tell this application what data centers do I want my application to run. And there it is. Here's my demo application. Note this is just for demo purposes. This is important. I can come in here and let's just say I want to call the site Azure Conf 2014. I can at this point come in and say that I want this application to be in the East Coast and the West Coast. I can just select my data centers. In fact, let me go ahead and do that. I got a check back, which means there's no traffic manager already called AC2014. There's no endpoint like that. So let me go ahead and select the East Coast data center, Azure data center here. Let's just go select the West Coast Azure data center here. And I'm going to leave the CSS and HTML files alone. I don't want to change this, but the idea is that you can very quickly supply that. And now let's go ahead and create this. Okay, so it is going to take a few minutes. It says 20 minutes, and the reason it's going to take 20 minutes is going to provision these web roles in these various data centers. Now you're probably asking yourself, Vishwas, why don't you use Azure websites? And I could have certainly used websites, but at that time, the traffic manager support was not there. Plus, I want to run cloud services in different data centers like the Azure government, which we'll talk about shortly. So we will come back to this demo and see how this is going, and then we will take a look at the traffic manager policies, etc. Meantime, let's just go back to our demonstration, to the slide deck. So what all have we talked about? We talked about the VS remote debugging. We talked about the resource group manager. I created a new resource group using the declarative model. Third thing we talked about was the VNet enhancements, and then we talked about the traffic manager. Moving on, I want to talk about this new capability of deployment, and you've heard something called the Docker and Kubernetes recently. In fact, there was a big news last week from Microsoft that Microsoft is going to support a version of Docker for the next version of Windows. So why is this important? This is important because Docker allows you to run these applications in a lightweight manner. In fact, let me just bring up the slide and explain this concept. So today, if you, let me get myself the laser pointer. So today, if you're running an application, so you have this one hypervisor layer, and then you have these multiple applications. Each application requires a copy of the OS. You can see an OS copy here, an OS copy here, an OS copy here. That's one problem. So now you're expending resources to run three copies of OSs, and you may not be taxing the system, that's one. The other problem is that as you're trying to move these applications, the hypervisors may be different, so you have to deal with that. So compare and contrast this to the Docker concept. So there's this host OS, and then on top of the host OS, you have this lightweight Docker engine, which think of this as a lightweight runtime, and any application that has been Dockerified or Docker enabled can run on this Docker engine. So you can see I still have one copy of my host OS, but I have multiple applications running. And this concept is really based on the concept of Linux containers. And only in 2013 did this concept become very popular. A company called Docker built on top of the Linux containers, but they came up with a standard way of packaging your application and a standard runtime which could run these applications. The concept took off, many companies signed on to this concept, and now you have hundreds and thousands of applications that are Docker enabled. So I'm going to show you a quick demonstration of that, and then I'll come back and talk about what it means to run to when we have Docker for Windows. So let me go ahead and bring up a Linux machine here. So this is my Docker client. And so right here, I have my Linux machine. But I should also show you one other thing that'll make sense here. And right now, I have two machines that I want to focus on. There's a machine called Admin VM for demo. This is the machine where I've installed a bunch of things. So this is an Ubuntu machine. I installed the Azure CLI on top of that. I installed the MongoDB, and then I installed the docker.io repo. So I have installed Docker on this machine. And then, so this is my client machine, think of this, and then I can now fire commands from here and create Docker containers. We will also be looking at this machine right here, which is serving as the host for our Docker containers. So I'm going to be talking about these two machines. Let's just go back to our virtual machine right here. And my virtual machine is right here. And right now I can come in here and I better run it in elevated mode. So Docker version, and this tells me what versions of Docker are there. Now, what I've also done is I've taken a couple of Docker-enabled applications and downloaded them here. So one of them, let's take a quick look. In fact, I should be having this in my cache, so I can up arrow key that. Let's just go ahead and run this. And you can see here, let me call this out. I have two applications that I've installed. One is the Platinum image, which is a variant of the main stack. And I also have a MongoDB image. And both of these images are installed in the following containers. Let me just bring up those containers as well. And let me just run this command, which is the Docker command. I'm communicating with that other machine and saying, please give me all of the Docker containers. And turns out that I have two Docker containers. First one is running the Platinum image. The other one is running the MongoDB image. Okay. Now, by virtue of downloading these images and then starting them in a container, I can go out and I've enabled the port, so we don't have to worry about that. I can go in here. And let me just bring up this application, this Platinum image that I just showed you. And you can see here that this is the MongoDB powered Platinum image that you are seeing here. Okay, so that's quite simple. All I did was I downloaded this image and then posted it in a container. Now, what Google did recently was, so Docker is fine. You can go create these Docker containers. But what Google did was wrote a cluster manager on top of Docker. So their idea is that there will be a master and there'll be minions, and Google's Kubernetes protocol is to manage these Docker containers. So in fact, let's just go and take a look. And what Windows Azure team did was they announced support for Kubernetes. So if I go here, let me just go into the virtual network here quickly. Let's just find network. And you can see here, let me just go for this virtual network and go into the configuration tab. And you will see that I have a bunch of machines. Let's just go here. And you can see here that this is my Kubernetes cluster. I have a Kubernetes master and a bunch of minions. They're all defined in the Azure VNet. So that's how the Azure networking came together here with Kubernetes concept. So what I've done here, let me just go ahead and bring up an API. So Kubernetes is a cluster manager, and it gives you a REST API. I can call that to figure out all of the pods that are running. And pods is the concept where you're combining Docker containers which have affinity. So let me run an API for you. And this is going to just give you some ugly JSON file. Let me zoom into this right here. I'm basically making a Kubernetes API call and getting all the list of pods that are there in the system. But this is not very pretty to look at. And what was interesting is, was recently there was a hackathon at Microsoft. And a bunch of people got together, used this API, and build a visualizer on top of this. So let's go ahead and take a look at that visualizer. So I'm going to bring that Kubernetes visualizer here. And you can see here, they're showing you all the pods. And I can come in here very quickly, say Azure Conf, and give me some additional pods. Let's just say two more pods. And it is going to go ahead. And because that image is downloaded, see how quickly these pods came up. So I could now these pods came up, and I can go install applications on it. I can add it to the cluster. In fact, they got added to the cluster, and I can change certain things with it. So going back to the slide here, so what Docker is giving me here is, in fact, let me go to the previous slide. So you can see Docker is a great deployment option. And by saying that Windows Server next version is going to support Docker, what we will get, hopefully, is that you can write a Windows application, Docker enable it, and then you'll be able to take that Docker application, that Windows-based Docker application, and run it on premises or in the cloud. So you have this concept available. So I'm very excited to read about this. Let's see when the bits become available. So that's the concept of Docker. And the last concept that I want to talk about in the section of developer enhancements is IaaS and PaaS together. So I talked about extensions as a way to bridge the gap. Recently, the Azure Websites team added a very useful capability. So up until now, Azure Websites could talk to an Azure SQL database, perhaps, but it never was able to connect into a virtual network, a low-level virtual network. So this was a recent announcement. So what I'm going to show you here is a combination of those two. And for this demo, what I did was I took the music store sample, which many of you know has been upgraded to the latest and greatest version of .NET. I took that sample, and I took the UI and the application tiers of that sample and ran that as an Azure website. And I did that, and then I opened up a connection between the Azure website and a VNet, and on that VNet, I hosted a high availability cluster. So let's go ahead and take a look. So I'm going to, first thing I'm going to do here is, let's just go to my Azure portal here, and let me just bring up the networking tab here, and I'm just going to go into this networking tab. Let's go into configuration here. We will talk about this networking in a lot more detail in a subsequent demo. The important thing I want to call out is that inside this network, you will see a point-to-site connectivity right here. You will see this here. And this is how the Azure website is then connecting into this virtual network. So this has been set up. So I told you already that I hosted the UI portion in Azure websites. Let's go ahead and take a look. So I'm going to go into the websites tab here, and I should see a music store. There you have it. Let's go click on the music store. Let's go into the dashboard, and let's see if I can bring this up in a new tab here. And this is very familiar to you guys, all I did here. So this is the music store sample. And instead of talking to an Azure SQL database, it is actually talking to a high always, SQL always on high availability cluster. And let me just show you that as well. So I'm going to RDP into another machine here. And this machine has my cluster right here. And you can see here, I have an availability group right here. And inside that availability group, I have, looks like I have one, let me just make sure refresh this. So that was, so it was showing as off because it was not refreshed. I have two secondaries, or I should say one primary and one secondary, and both of these, let's just take a quick look. This is going to be a synchronous secondary. So I have this MusicStore database, which is my database right here. And inside this database has one primary and one secondary, both are synchronous. And then I also have an asynchronous secondary, notice the name here, West Coast. So I have another database which is in the West Coast data center, which is acting as an asynchronous secondary. So let's go ahead and take a look at this. Let's look at the properties, and you will see that you have asynchronous here, okay? So now if I go back to the application here, and let's just bring this up. I had it somewhere here. Yes, I have the Music Store application right here. I can go play around. Now, why am I showing you this capability? The idea that I want to take from here is that for the parts that I wanted the PaaS service, the highly efficient way to deploy, the low cost of ownership, I went with Azure websites. But for the part of the database, perhaps I wanted to do encryption, perhaps I wanted a highly available database, perhaps my database scripts needed a certain capability which required me to use full-blown SQL Server, so I can combine the two in this manner. Okay, so let me go ahead and move to the next segment of the presentation, which is, let us talk about the IaaS enhancements for IT pros. And before we do that, let's just go back here and see if our traffic manager, remember that site we provision, is that demo up and running or not. So let's just go back here. And so this was our website that we provisioned right here. We will see if it is there yet or not. And let's just open it in a new tab and see if it did come up. Looks like it's not come up yet. Okay, so that takes, maybe it's not 20 minutes, but what I can do here very quickly, let's just see what portions of that service, you know, because it's a long process, it's provisioning the cloud services, then it is taking the endpoints of the cloud services, creating a traffic manager policy, so it's doing a bunch of things. Let's just try this in the meantime. I'm going to very quickly see if any cloud services got created. So right now I'm inside a PowerShell script and I'm just trying to dump out all of the cloud services with the name AC 2014. So let's just go ahead and run this and let's see what comes back. And yes, so our services did indeed get created. See here, there were two services that got created, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. So my sense is that our cloud services are ready, but our traffic manager policy is not quite ready yet. So we'll have to wait for a few more minutes and come back. And in the meantime, let's just go back. Let me just try to refresh it. It's not there yet. That's fine. Let's just go back to the IT Pro segment of the presentation. So the first thing I want to talk about here is the geo-redundant storage. So by default, when you store something in the blob storage, unless you tell them to explicitly not replicate, your data will be replicated to a data center which is at least 400 miles away. And the idea is that if there is a big contingency in your data center, the Azure team can then do a geo failover, which means you don't have to do anything. All your data will be served out of the second data center. But what if it is not a geo failover situation? In that case, there's a new capability called the read-only GRS capability, or read-accessible GRS, which means that you don't have to wait for a geo failover event. You can go to the secondary data center and access your data in a read-only manner. And then the other thing which is new is zone storage. So you're not trying to replicate the data to another data center, but your data is still spread out in the complex in that one region. So let me go show you a very quick demo of the read accessible GRS. And what I'm going to do here is, let's just go, and I'm going to bring up a tool that has been written by a fellow Azure MVP. So I'm going to bring up this tool called Cloud Portam, and you can check it out. I think it's in preview right now. And what I'm going to do when this tool comes up, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use it to show you the RAGRS capability. And in this case, just to mix things up, I'm using the Azure Government Cloud. So it is a community cloud designed for US-based government agencies. So it has all the standards, and on top of all of the compliance standards, but on top of that, all of the work is done by US citizens because it's a US-based community cloud. So I'm going to use that for my demonstration here. So what I'm going to show you here, let me just quickly log in. And we will use this tool to go inspect a blob storage container. And I'm going to go inspect a blob storage container, which is in Iowa, United States. And let me just bring up the right container. I want the blob service. And once this comes up, I am looking for the VHDs folder, or container, I should say. And then inside the VHD container, I have a bunch of images. These are images that are here. And if you notice here at the bottom, let me just bring this up also. Notice up here at the bottom, right now I'm connected to the primary data center, and that's why I have read-write and read-only access. In other words, I have full access available to me. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take a snapshot. Let me just go ahead and create a new snapshot. A snapshot has been taken, and let's just go view snapshots. So now I have one snapshot, and this is in GMT right here. You can see one snapshot was taken. And so you're probably wondering, if you're new to storage, you're wondering, how did come this large 128 gig file, I was able to take a snapshot quickly? That's because the storage is based on append-only model. So I could take a snapshot. In fact, you don't pay anything for the snapshot until you start deviating from the base image. So that's very interesting. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to switch data centers. And this tool that I'm using, it makes it super easy for me to do that. And I'm going to just click here. As you can see here, I'm going to click on the secondary. Let's just go ahead and click on secondary. And notice here that because I'm in the secondary, I only have read-only access. Okay, let's go back to our VHD file, and let's take a quick look at the snapshots that are available. And here you go. The snapshot that I just took moments ago in the Iowa data center is now available in Ashburn, Virginia. So that's an important concept, RAGRS. You can take advantage of this. You have a read-only copy of your data. Perhaps you want to do reporting. Perhaps you want to use it in your application in some manner. It's an important concept to know about, and as you're planning your application. So that's the geo-redundant storage. Let's move on and talk about some of the other networking enhancements. And I promised you a demo in this part, because in the developer portion, we just covered the concept slide. So let's go see a demo. But before we do that, a couple of quick points. So ExpressRoute, I've already talked about it, dedicated connection between your data center and Azure. You have the regional VNet. You have the load balancer. And the load balancer is important, and I should have mentioned this earlier. The internal load balancer is important because if you're trying to set up an always-on setup, the listener is based on an internal load balancer, and that's how you're able to get that availability. So I'll show you that in a second, and then you, of course, have the VNet to VNet connectivity. So let's go ahead and take a look. And to get a mental picture of this demonstration, let me bring up this slide. So what you're going to see here, and I can't show you all the pieces because this is a fairly involved setup, but I think it'll suffice to understand that I have two applications running in two different data centers in Azure. So the application, the East Coast, has a VNet, so it's a regional VNet. And then here I have the web tier. So I have the two applications now connected to the availability set. Remember, we talked about pairing of virtual machines. And then I have the internal load balancer, which is sort of acting as the listener, in this case, for my always-on setup. And then, in fact, the web tier is also an internal load balancer, because all my traffic, I don't have a public endpoint for this application, all my traffic is going to come through a VNet to VNet gate, or a site-to-site gateway. Okay? So that's my East Coast setup. And then on the West Coast, I have a very similar setup. I have the web tier, I have the SQL listener, and I have the two nodes here. So what we are going to do, and remember that the way the always-on cluster was set up, I had a primary and I had a secondary, a synchronous secondary. In fact, what I'm going to do here, I should have remembered to do this as part of this demonstration, I'm going to turn off one of the secondaries, one of the synchronous secondaries. So let me go ahead and select this. And I find it much easier to do this in PowerShell, because I don't have to keep switching subscriptions in the portal. Let's go ahead and stop one of the machines here. Okay. So let's just, that machine was already started. Looks like it's going to take some time here to go. So let's take a look. Let's RDP into this machine. And the machine that I want to RDP in is this machine right here. And once again, you've seen this. I have a secondary, I have a primary, and then I have an asynchronous secondary. Let me see if my PowerShell did indeed come back. It did come back. So now I'm able to go stop this. Let's just stop this machine here, because I only needed one synchronous secondary. And then I also have an asynchronous secondary. So once this machine stops, let's just go back here. And let us try to bring up my web application. So remember that this slide here, I'm going to bring up this web application next. Okay, so I think I have a shortcut saved somewhere for that. Let's go ahead and bring up this machine here. And let's just bring up the East Coast machine here. So I'm going to bring up, and I didn't tell you this earlier, but the two web applications are actually SharePoint web applications. So I'm going to bring this up. It takes a second to come up here. And in the meantime, let me go ahead and bring up the web application and the other data center as well. So let's go ahead and get to the other data center. And there you have it. So this is going to look like it's coming up. The West Coast data center did come up. And you are seeing this sign up at the top. We apologize for the inconvenience. It is actually a good message, because my asynchronous secondary is read-only. SharePoint is giving this message and telling you that you only have read-only access to this SharePoint site. Okay, something went wrong. Let's just go ahead and just, I think I stopped the database at the wrong time. There you go. So now I have this East Coast application right here. You can see I have this SharePoint site on the East Coast. And then if I come out of this, here is my read-only site on the West Coast. Okay, see this failover right here? I have this on the West Coast. Okay, so what we are going to do now is let's just go add a document in the East Coast SharePoint document library. So I'm going to go get a document and let's just add it to this document library and just save it. And let's save it here. And hopefully this document got uploaded quickly. So now, because I have the site pointed to the always-on cluster, I stored this document. Now, once this document got updated, the content DB in SharePoint got updated, and then this change was propagated through an asynchronous secondary to the West Coast data center. And if we go to the West Coast website now and just refresh it, we should hopefully see the new document. So you can see my document did make all its way through the asynchronous secondary to the West Coast data center, and I could see the document here. So that concludes this demonstration. So we talked about the network enhancements, we talked about the East region, West region. I'm going to next talk about, since we have less time here, I'm going to skip this demo. We'll see if we can come back to this. But I also want to quickly talk about the hardware improvements, and I don't need to explain why it helps. But you saw these announcements yesterday, the GCDs machines, the premium storage. And this is the point that I was making earlier, that if you're looking at lift and shift workloads, then having this extra compute capacity gives you the flexibility to move more performance intensive applications in a lift and shift manner to the cloud. So the other demonstration that I want to do, and if we get a minute or so, I'm going to come back to the remote app demo, but I want to show you this extensions demo here. And I talked about how the infrastructure service VMs now have an agent on them. And that agent is then used to bootstrap Microsoft and non-Microsoft extensions. And for this demo, what I did was I chose to use the Chef agent. And by the way, the concept of agent applies to the Windows machines and the Linux machine alike. So what I'm going to do here is going to show you a Chef demonstration. And the idea is, and Chef and Puppet, very popular tools. And in this case, and there was a recent announcement that Microsoft supports Chef and Puppet as extensions. So when you create a virtual machine through the portal, you can say that this virtual machine, you want the Chef agent put on that machine. And then when that machine comes up, it dials home into the Chef server, it downloads the cookbook and executes it. Okay, that's the general idea. So I'm going to show this to you. And let's just remote desktop into this machine right here. So let us remote desktop into the Chef workstation. Let me expand this. And what I have here is a very simple IIS install, and I'm going to go make a quick change to this application here. So let's see. Oh, looks like my connection is frozen. That's fine. Let me just go ahead and RDP into it again. And okay, let's go into this time, hopefully. So I have the Chef workstation, and I have a very simple IIS application. What I'm going to do is make a small change to that IIS application. So let's go ahead and take a look. So I have this index.html page. Let's just say, welcome to Azure Conf. Okay, I'll remove this here. And I'm going to go save this page. And then the other thing I'm going to do very quickly is give this application a new version number. So this is a very simple example where I'm taking this package and then changing the properties of this cookbook and then upload it. So let me just go ahead and save this. And now I have saved this. Let's just go ahead and upload this package to the Chef server so I can have a hosted Chef machine, or I can, you know, create a Chef server and install it locally. So it looks like my workbook got uploaded. So if I now go to the hosted Chef service here, let's go ahead and refresh this page here. So my new version is available, and the way I can tell that my new version is available, I can come into the templates and I can see that right here, this is the text we added, remember? So what we did was we created a cookbook, uploaded it to the Chef server, And then once I've uploaded it to the chef's server, what I can do now is I can take one of the machines, and one of the machines is listed here. I can see all the nodes that are here. So I have this machine called the first VM node. This machine has the chef agent installed on it. So this agent is going to go out to the chef server and say, oh, you have a new package for me. And then it is going to go execute this package. And if you had time to run this, it would just show us the new website with this change on it. So this was the last demonstration that I wanted to cover here. Let me very quickly take this question that I see on the screen. What is the question from Luis? Which is the best scenario to back up VM on-premises to Azure? So Luis's question is that they're running VMs in their on-premises data center, I presume. How do you go about backing up? And I would highly recommend you take a look at the Azure Site Recovery, because that's a great option for you. You can install it, and then you can take that tool to back up your machines in Azure, and you can do that quite simply. So hopefully that answers your question. And I don't see any more questions here listed. So with this, I would like to summarize and end this session. Thank you for watching. I hope you find this useful. I will say the thing I said at the beginning. For us to make the cloud successful, IT pros need to think like developers, learn JSON, learn REST API. And developers need to understand the underpinnings of the data center so that they can define more cost-effective, scalable, and robust applications. Thank you so much.